Sylvie and Bruno by Lewis Carroll. Preface. Editorial note by the reader. This preface contains references to page numbers from the original text. These references, as well as the author's notation of an interruption while composing the preface, have been retained in the audio format for purposes of historical accuracy. These page numbers do not correspond to any actual textual locations in the accompanying web version of the text. One little picture in this book, The Magic Locket, at page 77, was drawn by Miss Alice Havers. I did not state this on the title page, since it seemed only due to the artist of all these, to my mind, wonderful pictures, that his name should stand there alone. The descriptions at pages 386 and 387 of Sunday, as spent by children of the last generation, are quoted verbatim from a speech made to me by a child friend and a letter written to me by a lady friend. The chapters headed Fairy Sylvie and Bruno's Revenge are a reprint with a few alterations of a little fairy tale which I wrote in the year 1867 at the request of the late Mrs. Gaddy for Aunt Judy's Magazine, which she was then editing. It was in 1874, I believe, that the idea first occurred to me of making it the nucleus of a longer story. As the years went on, I jotted down at odd moments all sorts of odd ideas and fragments of dialogue that occurred to me, who knows how, with a transitory suddenness that left me no choice but either to record them then and there or to abandon them to oblivion. Sometimes one could trace to their source these random flashes of thought as being suggested by the book one was reading, or struck out from the flint of one's own mind by the steel of a friend's chance remark, but they had also a way of their own of occurring apropos of nothing, specimens of that hopelessly illogical phenomenon, an effect without a cause. Such, for example, was the last line of The Hunting of the Snark, which came into my head, as I have already related, in the theater for April of 1887, quite suddenly during a solitary walk. And such again have been passages which occurred in dreams, and which I cannot trace to any antecedent cause whatever. There are at least two instances of such dream suggestions in this book. One, my lady's remark, "It often runs in families, just as a love for pastry does," at page 88, the other, Eric Linden's badinage about having been in domestic service, at page 332. And thus it came to pass that I found myself at last in possession of a huge, unwieldy mass of literature, if the reader will kindly excuse the spelling, which only needed stringing together upon the thread of a consecutive story to constitute the book I hoped to write. Only. The task at first seemed absolutely hopeless, and gave me a far clearer idea than I ever had before of the meaning of the word chaos. And I think it must have been 10 years or more before I had succeeded in classifying these odds and ends sufficiently to see what sort of story they indicated. For the story had to grow out of the incidents, not the incidents out of the story. I am telling all this in no spirit of egoism, but because I really believe that some of my readers will be interested in these details of the genesis of a book, which looks so simple and straightforward a matter, when completed, that they might suppose it to have been written straight off, page by page, as one would write a letter, beginning at the beginning and ending at the end. It is no doubt possible to write a story in that way, and, if it be not vanity to say so, I believe that I could, myself, if I were in the unfortunate position, for I do hold it to be a real misfortune, of being obliged to produce a given amount of fiction in a given time, that I could fulfill my task and produce my tale of bricks, as other slaves have done. One thing, at any rate, I could guarantee, as to the story so produced, that it should be utterly commonplace, should contain no new ideas whatever, and should be very, very weary reading. This species of literature has received the very appropriate name of padding, which might fitly be defined as that which all can write and none can read. That the present volume contains no such writing, I dare not avow. Sometimes, in order to bring a picture into its proper place, it has been necessary to eke out a page with two or three extra lines. But I can honestly say I have put in no more than I was absolutely compelled to do. My readers may perhaps like to amuse themselves by trying to detect in a given passage the one piece of padding it contains. While arranging the slips into pages, I found that the passage, which now extends from the top of page 35 to the middle of page 38, was three lines too short. I supplied the deficiency not by interpolating a word here and a word there, but by writing in three consecutive lines. Now, can my readers guess which they are? A harder puzzle, if a harder be desired, would be to determine, as to the gardener's song, in which cases, if any, the stanza was adapted to the surrounding text, and in which, if any, the text was adapted to the stanza. Perhaps the hardest thing in all literature, at least I have found it so, by no voluntary effort can I accomplish it, I have to take it as it comes, is to write anything original. And perhaps the easiest is, when once an original line has been struck out, to follow it up and to write any amount more to the same tune. I do not know if Alice in Wonderland was an original story. I was at least no conscious imitator in writing it. But I do know that, since it came out, something like a dozen storybooks have appeared on identically the same pattern. The path I timidly explored, believing myself to be the first that ever burst into that silent sea, is now a beaten high road. All the wayside flowers have long ago been trampled into the dust, and it would be courting disaster for me to attempt that style again. Hence it is that in Sylvie and Bruno I have striven with I know not what success to strike out yet another new path, be it bad or good. It is the best I can do. It is written not for money and not for fame, but in the hope of supplying for the children whom I love some thoughts that may suit those hours of innocent merriment which are the very life of childhood, and also in the hope of suggesting to them and to others some thoughts that may prove, I would fain hope, not wholly out of harmony with the graver cadences of life. If I have not already exhausted the patience of my readers, I would like to seize this opportunity, perhaps the last I shall have of addressing so many friends at once, of putting on record some ideas that have occurred to me as to books desirable to be written, which I should much like to attempt, but may not ever have the time or power to carry through, in the hope that, if I should fail, and the years are gliding away very fast, to finish the task I have set myself, others may take it up. First, a child's Bible. The only real essentials of this would be carefully selected passages suitable for a child's reading and pictures. One principle of selection which I would adopt would be that religion should be put before a child as a revelation of love. No need to pain and puzzle the young mind with the history of crime and punishment. On such a principle I should, for example, omit the history of the flood. The supplying of the pictures would involve no great difficulty. No new ones would be needed. Hundreds of excellent pictures already exist, the copyright of which has long ago expired, and which simply need photozincography or some similar process for their successful reproduction. The book should be handy in size, with a pretty, attractive-looking cover, in a clear legible type, and above all, with abundance of pictures, pictures, pictures. Secondly, a book of pieces selected from the Bible. Not single texts, but passages from 10 to 20 verses each, to be committed to memory. Such passages would be found useful to repeat to oneself and to ponder over on many occasions when reading is difficult, if not impossible, for instance, when lying awake at night, on a railway journey, when taking a solitary walk in old age, when eyesight is failing or wholly lost, and best of all, when illness, while incapacitating us for reading or any other occupation, condemns us to lie awake through many weary silent hours. At such time, how keenly one may realize the truth of David's rapturous cry, "Oh, how sweet are thy words unto my throat, yea, sweeter than honey unto my mouth." I have said passages rather than single texts, because we have no means of recalling single texts. Memory needs links, and here are none. One may have 100 texts stored in the memory and not be able to recall at will more than 6, and those by mere chance. Whereas, once get hold of any portion of a chapter that has been committed to memory, and the whole can be recovered. All hangs together. Thirdly, a collection of passages, both prose and verse, from books other than the Bible. There is not perhaps much in what is called uninspired literature. A misnomer, I hold, if Shakespeare was not inspired, one may well doubt if any man ever was, that will bear the process of being pondered over 100 times. Still, there are such passages, enough, I think, to make a goodly store for the memory. These two books of sacred and secular passages for memory will serve other good purposes besides merely occupying vacant hours. They will help to keep at bay many anxious thoughts, worrying thoughts, uncharitable thoughts, unholy thoughts. Let me say this, in better words than my own, by copying a passage from that most interesting book, Robertson's Lectures on the Epistles to the Corinthians, Lecture 49. If a man finds himself haunted by evil desires and unholy images, which will generally be at periodical hours, let him commit to memory passages of Scripture or passages from the best writers in verse or prose. Let him store his mind with these as safeguards to repeat when he lies awake in some restless night or when despairing imaginations or gloomy suicidal thoughts beset him. Let these be to him the sword turning everywhere to keep the way of the garden of life from the intrusion of profaner footsteps. Fourthly, a Shakespeare for girls, that is, an edition in which everything not suitable for the perusal of girls of, say, from 10 to 17, should be omitted. Few children under 10 would be likely to understand or enjoy the greatest of poets, and those who have passed out of girlhood may safely be left to read Shakespeare in any edition, expurgated or not, that they may prefer. But it seems a pity that so many children in the intermediate stage should be debarred from a great pleasure for want of an edition suitable to them. Neither Bowdler's, Chambers, Brandram's, nor Cundell's Boudoir Shakespeare seems to me to meet the want. They're not sufficiently expurgated. Bowdler's is the most extraordinary of all. Looking through it, I am filled with a deep sense of wonder, considering what he has left in, that he should have cut anything out. Besides, relentlessly erasing all that is unsuitable on the score of reverence or decency, I should be inclined to admit almost all that seems too difficult or not likely to interest young readers. The resulting book might be slightly fragmentary, but it would be a real treasure to all British maidens who have any taste for poetry. If it be needful to apologize to anyone for the new departure I have taken in this story by introducing, along with what will, I hope, prove to be acceptable nonsense for children, some of the graver thoughts of human life, it must be to one who has learned the art of keeping such thoughts wholly at a distance in hours of mirth and careless ease. To him, such a mixture will seem, no doubt, ill-judged and repulsive. And that such an art exists, I do not dispute. With youth, good health, and sufficient money, it seems quite possible to lead, for years together, a life of unmixed gaiety, with the exception of one solemn fact, with which we are liable to be confronted at any moment, even in the midst of the most brilliant company or the most sparkling entertainment. A man may fix his own times for admitting serious thought, for attending public worship, for prayer, for reading the Bible. All such matters he can defer to that convenient season, which is so apt never to occur at all. But he cannot defer for one single moment the necessity of attending to a message which may come before he has finished reading the page. This night shalt thy soul be required of thee. The ever-present sense of this grim possibility has in all ages an incubus that men have striven to shake off. Author's note. At the moment when I had written these words, there was a knock at the door and a telegram was brought to me announcing the sudden death of a dear friend. Continuing. Few more interesting subjects of enquiry could be found by a student of history than the various weapons that have been used against this shadowy foe. Saddest of all must have been the thoughts of those who saw indeed an existence beyond the grave, but an existence far more terrible than annihilation, an existence as filmy, impalpable, all but invisible specters drifting about through endless ages in a world of shadows with nothing to do, nothing to hope for, nothing to love. In the midst of the gay verses of that genial bon vivant Horace, there stands one dreary word whose utter sadness goes to one's heart. It is the word exilium in the well-known passage, Omnes eodem cogimur omnium, versator urna sirius osius, sors exitura et nos in eternum exilium impositura simbe. Yes, to him this present life, spite of all its weariness and all its sorrow, was the only life worth having. All else was exile. Does it not seem almost incredible that one holding such a creed should ever have smiled? And many in this day, I fear, even though believing in an existence beyond the grave far more real than Horace ever dreamed of, yet regard it as a sort of exile from all the joys of life, and so adopt Horace's theory and say, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." We go to entertainments, such as the theater. I say we, for I also go to the play whenever I get a chance of seeing a really good one, and keep at arm's length, if possible, the thought that we may not return alive. Yet how do you know, dear friend, whose patience has carried you through this garrulous preface, that it may not be your lot, when mirth is fastest and most furious, to feel the sharp pang or the deadly faintness which heralds the final crisis, to see with vague wonder anxious friends bending over you to hear their troubled whispers, perhaps yourself to shape the question with trembling lips, "Is it serious?" and to be told, "Yes, the end is near," and, oh, how different all life will look when those words are said. How do you know, I say, that all this may not happen to you this night? And dare you, knowing this, say to yourself, "Well, perhaps it is an immoral play. Perhaps the situations are a little too risky, the dialogue a little too strong, the business a little too suggestive. I don't say that conscience is quite easy, but the piece is so clever, I must see it this once. I'll begin a stricter life tomorrow, tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow." Who sins in hope, who sinning says, "Sorrow for sin God's judgment stays, against God's spirit he lies, quite stops mercy with insult, dares, and drops, like a scorched fly that spins in vain upon the axis of its pain, then takes its doom to limp and crawl, blind and forgot from fall to fall." Let me pause for a moment to say that I believe this thought of the possibility of death, if calmly realized and steadily faced, would be one of the best possible tests as to our going to any scene of amusement, being right or wrong. If the thought of sudden death acquires for you a special horror when imagined as happening in a theater, then be very sure the theater is harmful for you, however harmless it may be for others, and that you are incurring a deadly peril in going. Be sure the safest rule is that we should not dare to live in any scene in which we dare not die. But once realize what the true object is in life, that it is not pleasure, not knowledge, not even fame itself, that last infirmity of noble minds, but that it is the development of character, the rising to a higher, nobler, purer standard, the building up of the perfect man, and then, so long as we feel that this is going on, and will, we trust, go on for evermore, death has for us no terror. It is not a shadow, but a light, not an end, but a beginning. One other matter that may perhaps seem to call for apology, that I should have treated with such entire want of sympathy the British passion for sport, which no doubt has been in bygone days and is still in some forms of it an excellent school for hardihood and for coolness in moments of danger. But I am not entirely without sympathy for genuine sport. I can heartily admire the courage of the man who, with severe bodily toil and, at the risk of his life, hunts down some man-eating tiger, and I can heartily sympathize with him when he exults in the glorious excitement of the chase and the hand-to-hand struggle with the monster brought to bay. But I can but look with deep wonder and sorrow on the hunter who, at his ease and in safety, can find pleasure in what involves for some defenseless creature wild terror and a death of agony, deeper if the hunter be one who has pledged himself to preach to men the religion of universal love, deepest of all if it be one of those tender and delicate beings whose very name serves as a symbol of love, Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women, whose mission here is surely to help and comfort all that are in pain or sorrow. Farewell, farewell, but this I tell to thee, thou wedding guest. He prayeth well who loveth well, both man and bird and beast. He prayeth best who loveth best all things, both great and small. For the dear God who loveth us, he made and loveth all. The end of the author's preface. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.